Anyway, okay, so what I was going to, what I will do is a little bit out of order. Instead of talking about bacteria, which I promised one member of the audience I wouldn't touch, I will start with fly and probably run through the hour with the humble insect. So I will talk a bit about what one can do computationally in deciphering the regulatory network in fly using the AP axis as the paradigm, because it's very well studied. I will say a bit about how one can take chunks of sequence and infer sites. I will then also, I will also mention what can be extracted from interspecies comparisons, and also, though it's not on here, talk a bit about so-called insulator elements, which you might think of as being punctuations in the regulatory sequences. So to get on with this, some numbers just to remind you of the sizes of things. Obviously, these unicellular organisms, nothing back here, oh, here we are, have a couple of thousand genes, genome sizes measured in megabases. And for our purposes, roughly 80% of the genome is devoted to making coding for proteins, to be contrasted with the model organisms where the numbers are reversed, i.e., 20% of the genome is protein coding, the rest something else, plausibly regulatory in these things. The other thing that's worthy of emphasis is the number of regulatory proteins, which is in the hundreds for these bacteria and yeast. And if you check in GenBank and do a search under E. coli and transcription, you will get 10 to the fourth papers coming back, similarly for yeast. And of those 10 to the fourth papers, they have enumerated they have analyzed the regulation of perhaps several hundred genes in E. coli, and they have analyzed, they will give you the binding sites for perhaps 60 of those 300 factors, i.e. a relatively small fraction. So one doesn't have much option but to consider some of these problems computationally, because one's never going to get to the end of it in any other way. So let me now just jump up to the fly stuff. And okay. So in dealing with fly, there are a couple of good recent books which, if you like, celebrate and work through this fruitful recent convergence of evolution with development. Eric Davidson has written one such book. He was here 2 weeks ago. Another such book is by Sean Carroll and co-workers from Wisconsin, whose cover I flash at you here. If you look in detail at this cover, you will note what is either a 20-foot-long caterpillar crawling up a palm tree, or a 6-inch palm tree with a normal caterpillar in front of the pyramids. And anyway, it's not quite clear where this cover came from. But obviously, they didn't appreciate scales and scaling of things back then. In any event, this very fruitful convergence of these subjects has its antecedents in the late 19th, early 20th century with these very bizarre mutants, which changed numbers of fingers, numbers of vertebrae, and such things. If you ever go into a museum of comparative anatomy from that period, such as exists in Paris, there's a corner of the museum with sort of monstrosities in it. In other words, various bizarre mutations, which with more work, some number of these things were shown to result from relatively few mutations, giving rise to very seemingly very large changes in morphology. More recently, we have obviously data from genome sequences. One has learned that the number of genes in from fly and human is not that dramatically different. All the signaling pathways in human are represented in the fly, and the types of genes are very similar. In human, there being more duplications of basic types. One way to understand how things have evolved is to understand how they develop and do, and do comparative development. And you quickly learn when studying development that how you make, how you differentiate cells starting from an egg is via a very heavy dose of transcriptional regulation and regulatory cascades. So that is the focus of these books. The other important bit of information that has been gleaned from a large number of experiments is that in metazoans, a lot of the regulation is in contiguous chunks of DNA which retain their functionality when moved around the genome, and in particular put in front of a non-native reporter gene. So that's an important organizational principle which has been seen in many experiments, and obviously has implications for how you might evolve these things. The ultimate goal, of course, is to make the genome not a parts list, as they say in the popular press, but more an assembly manual. Fly, as those of you who were here a couple of weeks ago heard in great detail, is a model developmental organism beginning early in the last century. The head-to-tail anterior-posterior axis formation is particularly well studied. There are lots and lots of mutants that are known. I will show you the regulatory network on the next slide. And that developmental process is very heavily transcriptional in nature. The end point of the AP, or the blastoderm axis formation, feeds into these things called HOX or selector genes, which are responsible for defining cell fate. So for example, week before last you heard about ilis, distalis, whose mutations affect limb development, vestigial, which affects wing development, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a host of these things, which together with these HOX genes, which are expressed in these various domains, then define, among other things, the appendages. And it was mutations in these HOX genes that are responsible, for example, for this oft-shown four-winged fly that Lewis produced, or further analyzed, it was known earlier. Also, it should be remarked that these HOX genes are immensely similar between fly and humans. You would have more copies, but it's very easy to take the fly genes and find by homology or hybridization the human homologs. So you see here the array anterior to posterior, which these various genes are expressed, and you see then in the embryo of the segments which are expressed where. This lifted from Carroll's book. This is a rough summary of the pathway. There are several of these genes which are maternal, Bicoid and Hunchback. The first group, so-called gap genes, are all transcription factors. The lower bunch here are expressed in the embryo. This group feeds into a so-called pair rule group, most of which are here. This is hairy in abbreviation. These large arrows arise from genetic experiments where one finds that mutations up here affect patterns here and not the converse. The segment polarity group you heard about from Gary O'Dell 2 weeks ago, so that's responsible for defining anterior, posterior parts of segments. Many of the genes here are signaling molecules, wingless, DPP, hedgehog, and various factors that go with them. Most of the genes here are still transcription factors. At this point, one has cells, and therefore one has intercellular signaling going on. Finally, these various groups all feed into the HOX genes, roughly shown there. The lists here are rather incomplete, but you get the sense of it all. So this is a big mass of spaghetti, which one now wants to ask how much one can understand from the genome and computationally. Part of the rich inheritance we have from 20 plus years of experimental work is shown here. The pictures on the left are lifted from John Reinitz, whose website has lots of colored pictures of this sort. They show two of the gap gene inputs, hunchback and crupal, and as well as the gene they feed into, Eve. If we go back to the previous picture, I am showing you hunchback and crupal up here feeding into Eve over here. So, what you see from analyzing, firstly, there are of course genetic experiments which tell you what influences what. Then there are more quantitative experiments that Reinitz has perhaps pushed hardest and pioneered, in which you simply measure these profiles. So for example, you take this picture and you measure the hunchback profile head to tail, and you get a graph like this. You measure the crupal profile over here. You see, for example, that the, you can read it off here, that the hunchback profile just overlaps stripe 2 of Eve, the yellow. The crupal profile abuts stripe 2 of Eve over here. I haven't shown you giant, but giant would abut the stripe 2 of Eve on the anterior side. So by looking at many such pictures, and also then in doing experiments and asking what happens when you remove crupal, they have come to the conclusion that with regards this stripe 2, giant and crupal act as repressors of it, and hunchback and bicoid, to a lesser extent, act as activators of it. The important, I guess, remark, which didn't come in the right order, is that the stripe 2 element is, if you like, the hydrogen atom of fly modulology, in the sense that it is that Steve and others have shown that you can take a half kilobase chunk of DNA and hook it up to a reporter gene, and that that assemblage, when integrated into the genome, will quite faithfully reproduce transcription in stripe number 2, which you would see if I overlaid this thing with a stain for the entire Eve pattern. So it's with respect to this module that people have, one, mapped these various crupal, giant, bicoid, and hunchback sites, and then also shown in a number of cases that, then shown the repressor function, i.e. you remove crupal and the Eve domain expands this way, you remove giant, it expands this way, et cetera, et cetera. And furthermore, people have shown that when you mutate selected of these sites, that inhibition or excitation function is resonant, works through those sites. So one really has tied up, in this case, in a very neat pattern. Yes? Okay, yes, interesting question. What Steve will tell you privately, though apparently I don't think he's written it down, is that if you remove giant, the stripe does not extend all the way to the head. So there's other stuff in there, which they do not know after 20 years. Yes, among other things, but that certainly is true.
But that is very mysterious because the stuff upstream, the choice of possible suspects upstream of Eve is very limited.
Yeah.
And various people certainly claim that that list is exhausted.
Yeah.
So does this mean that something is missing from that list? One can conceivably hook up appropriate spatial influence from linear combinations of existing
patterns? I don't. Okay, there is a talus up there, which sometimes is repressive, which defines these. So that could do it, but that I don't think has been checked. And Steve has not published this. I mean, biologists don't publish negative things, regrettably. But he'll tell you that. Yes? Okay, so the remarkable fact is that what I've shown you, the remarkable fact is that this chunk of DNA, which is half a kilobase, whose position in the genome I'll show you in a moment, this in isolation tacked on to a reporter will give you this pattern which accurately recapitulates in space and in time the second stripe of the endogenous gene, which is here, which has other activating elements, some which I'll show you. So, but that's a non-trivial and remarkable fact, that it really parses this way. Yes?
Anyone ever checked whether a decoy could actually present the
hyperconcentration? I am not aware of that. And do I know that? I don't know. I will show you a situation where hunchback is repressive in a moment. Reines and such people will tell you that not all is understood in this hydrogen atom. This, I very briefly, is stripe 3-7. This story is similar. But to make the remark that, you know, so here again, there's inputs from hunchback, knerps, hunchback again, talus and whatnot. Okay, 3 and 7 are parsed together as a single module, which is schematized here. And the reason for that is plausibly that now hunchback, okay, again, this is the module, this is the expression pattern. You remove hunchback and these stripes expand anteriorly, posteriorly. You remove knerps, they expand this way. So you infer here that the hunchback is repressive, knerps is repressive. You may ask what activates. What activates in this case is this thing called S, which is a STAT protein, which appears to be a ubiquitous activator. Another player, not in that list, ubiquitous activator. The other remark we made, which comes from Steve Small again, is that if you look at the inputs to stripe 4-6, which also share a module, they are plausibly riding on the same gradients, i.e. 4 is here, 6 is here. They're sort of sitting here and here and seeing somewhat the same inputs. So there you have a situation where you could rationalize a little bit what gets parsed with what. But I think it's a very open question to ask. Now you look at the other pair rule genes, you know, hairy, runt, etc., who take input from the gap genes, do those, you may ask, how do those things parse their stripes? Which stripes co-occur in the same module? And is this parsing invariant among organisms? The latter question we have not a clue about, but obviously is interesting and can be approached computationally. But it's not at all obvious that full pattern breaks up into modules is not so preordained. And we'd be very curious to see how that happens in a related fly. Yes?
Stripe 7 is somewhat wimpy.
Yes? You'll see a lot of those. Yes? Yes?
These
elements do not fully 100% recapitulate the native pattern. It's not clear to me how much of that is embryo to embryo variation. You'll see on some of the pictures that have been taken from the Rockefeller experiments that things are a little bit wishy-washy. And those seem to be the prevailing standards as to what you call success. But it's certainly true that, and you know, this is the question, is how quantitative these things are. You know, when you start, if you look at that paper, you know, when you start putting a lot more stuff in, sometimes these things sharpen up a little bit. You'll see, I'll show you examples of that. It's somewhat variable.
So
this is considered good. As far as anybody knows, there's no other module 7. This is it. But you know, there could be little bits of this, little bit of that. So this type of question, which is not much discussed in literature, gives you an impression as to how autonomous and complete these modules are, which is reasonable. But you know, it's not a hydrogen atom, regrettably.
Have the control regions to the other pair rule genes been identified in the same way?
Yes, I will show you for Eve. Yes, and I will show.
For Eve, I think you're pushing the rats another
way. It's very sporadic. Hairy, yes. Runt, some of them, but in much bigger chunks.
Okay, but there's no evidence that different principles are involved.
No evidence. But there's a lot, I'll show you some cases where it's rather unclear what's doing it. There's a lot of mystery here, it must be said. Okay, I very quickly, for reasons to become apparent, remind you of this picture which you remember from Mike Levine 2 weeks ago. He looked at the dorsal protein, its gradient from ventral to dorsal, high here, low here, various genes that are activated by dorsal and ventral region. The thing I want to flag here is just a footnote, if you like, is that in the dorsal region, dorsal acts as a repressor for these proteins expressed back here. So dorsal activates targets here, it represses targets here, particularly those. Now this is interesting because in this particular case, this is like another hydrogen atom for combinatorial control. It's very well worked out in the case of dorsal that when it acts as a repressor, it does so because of cofactors, dead ringer being one, this being another, cofactors that have their own particular DNA binding sites, which then hook up to this integrator Groucho, which then contacts the basal transcription machinery and turns and gives you and is responsible for this whole system, then implements the repression. The reason for making this remark in this context is that there's a very direct and unambiguous sequence tag for the circumstances in which dorsal acts repressively, i.e. there are sites for this cofactor. A similar scenario was sketched out to you by Rich Mann when he talked about, say, UBX and its cofactors extra-dentical and homothorax. Again, there's a very well-defined sequence footprint for that combination which acts repressively. Obviously, as you would infer here, the authors of this review were interested in Groucho, judging by its large and central position. And there are also very, very good mammalian homologs to these things, again showing you the how things can be boosted from fly to human. And of course, if you were interested, of course, this box here for leplimerase actually has some 50 factors in it, which other people study. Okay. I think these are certainly this to this is very well established. I know less about these two guys, but this to this is very well established. I mean, this NF kappa B and this thing are very close, and the I kappa B is cactus and so on. Do they say that?
Well, no.
No. This. Okay. That I'm not clear. I mean, again, this to this is very good, and this to this is very good. Those are the ones I know. With everything in place, you get transcription. Repression. Dorsal is a repressor, right? So the whole mess with Groucho represses. So we remove Groucho, you get activation.
And mammalian
is also. I don't know. It's drawn differently. I don't know. I believe because this and this go with the repression. Yeah, I believe so. You have to check the reference. It's repressive, sorry. But to remind you that there are big complexes involved. Right, and of course, there's actually a couple of kilobases between this and this, which is not drawn. And of course, I haven't shown you crystal structures. Okay, now, the numbers in the case of fly, you have about 120 megabases of assembled sequence. 20% of that is coding. Of the assembled sequence, there is very little that you could find to be obvious repeats of any sort, 5%. The modules, I just recapitulate the definition. I will show you two computational schemes, one of which takes a sample of known binding sites for factors which are known to work in a particular pathway, i.e. AP axis development, and looks for clusters of similar sites. Algorithm number two says, if I know one or several modules with a related function, can I pull out binding sites? So let's see what happens. This AHAB, this is the only thing with numbers on it. this AHAB code is a relatively is a rather simple construction. First of all, you have to have samples of binding sites for a factor. So if this is my sample, I convert these to a frequency matrix by just counting bases, positions, and columns. So this is 3/4 A in the first position. It's entirely A in the second position. It's 1/4 T in the first position, et cetera. If my background is half AT, what this model does is to fit to the data a model which says that I have this set of factors or background. I pick from this set independently with probabilities. If I pick a factor with a certain probability, I sample it, and then I use this to construct the sequence. And one should think of this just as data fitting. My model is that I have unknown probabilities, but known matrices. The model is that I pick things at random, and I just fit the statistical model to the data, optimize parameters, and see what I get. So in a little bit more detail, if this is my data, I could parse it in various ways, break it up. For each of these ways of breaking it up, here I choose AA. Here I create the AA by sampling the matrix, fill in the background, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So for these various ways of parsing the data, there are various probabilities. I add them up, and I get this expression for the probability of the data given the model, i.e. in this matrix. I then maximize the probabilities, and I get overall the probability of data given model as 9/64. If I have only background, I would have gotten 1/8, the ratio being 9/8, being the score, being positive. So this is the game. It's simply, again, it's simply curve fitting or data fitting. Given the model of independent matrices dropped down and sampled. Okay, now we apply this to early blastoderm. So we use maternal factors, we use zygotic factors relevant to the AP axis. We look in windows of the size, et cetera, et cetera. We come out, so the code allows us to rank all possible windows. So we run over the genome, and we rank things, and we take, for various reasons, the top 150 or so of putative modules. Most of these putative modules are intergenic. Very few are in coding regions. They come in various categories, and I will show you in a moment the various in situs that were done on genes which we otherwise knew nothing about function for. So we just did an in situ against the RNA for the gene. So we tried 24 genes which were close to 24 otherwise unassignable modules. If you add up the various figures, we are estimating a 50% false positive rate. So half of the 146 are real, the other ones are garbage, potentially. Okay, we then also checked 7 of these modules as modules, i.e. we stuck them in front of some reporter, and we then made the transgenic and looked. All of these came out to be positive, at least as regards blastoderm expression. I'll show you the pictures. 4 of these recapitulated the endogenous pattern. 3 did not. And you'll see the pictures in a moment. Okay, firstly, what does the output look like? We borrow this web browser. We take this web browser from Lincoln Stein at Cold Spring Harbor, who has developed it. This is the region around the Eve gene. So this is Eve sitting here. These traces horizontally are the results of this program, i.e. they give you the energy, the score, the log odd score, as a function of position along the genome. And the various traces reflect various parameter inputs or various background models. So here from 2 to 3, we're fiddling with how elaborately we define the background. Here we're using windows of different length, and we're throwing in pair rule input as well as gap gene input. Yes, it's actually a Markov model.
Okay, so there is some background. something.
Yes, yes, there is. Fit in various ways. Yes. Yes, right. So this is Markov 2, this is Markov 1.
But if it's Markov 2, every time you pick a background,
yes.
You always pick a two bases?
Yes. Markov 2 would say that you take two preceding bases to predict the third. Usual Markov model.
But when you segment, right, you have motif
1. Yes, yes.
And something
yes,
like
yes. Yes.
So something you return can have variable length?
Yes, certainly. Right. It could have length 1, in which case I take the two preceding things and predict.
So the weight matrices you use from known size.
Yes.
And
yes.
Right.
And the overall coefficient I fiddle with, the weight I fiddle with. So the number of copies of weight matrix in the window I fit. So, for example, for that Eve stripe, I should come back with Bicoid, Hunchback,
but
Giant.
Bootstrap,
right, I do not. Right. Yes. So you see here the extent to which we get the various prominent features on Eve. So this is 3.7 over here. We hit that. This is 2. We hit that. This should be 4.6. We're somewhat hitting that. This is other inputs. This is later in development. This one we missed completely. This is stripe 5. Now, some of the structure sitting in here, of course, may be real. And one question that will be come up continuously in the following is when you see bumps and wiggles like this, which are not an annotated site, are they real, or even if they're not real, are they potentially real? I.e., are these things the bits of semi-correlated pattern on which evolution might operate to make or to fiddle with the stripe arrangement? In other words, could you imagine that in an other organism, this thing has become more prominent and carries part of the native pattern? Now, it's not clear. Because you're concentrating the stuff in, you're either diluting it with random stuff or you're concentrating it.
You see that on bumps, there are deep bumps where you don't see that kind of pattern on the window.
Right, okay, I'm sorry. Here, what's also happening here, I'm cheating, I am adding pair rule input. So I'm using different matrices. I'm adding pair, so there's different inputs. So if you compare these things, you are seeing that these other matrices are playing a role. And that will be apparent in other pictures. So I'm playing with lots of things here. Yeah.
So the green module is the thing that makes it right, so expressing 3.7. All the others are repressors? Or?
No, these are all active. This thing in isolation will give you stripe 3 plus 7. This will give you stripe 2. This 4 plus 6. This 5.
So the other modules play a role later in stages of
the... No, the various stripes come on more at the same time. This guy is involved in heart development, and then this one is a auto activator. And I'm not sure where one is, I confess. These are the pictures of the in situs done on genes that otherwise had no known blastoderm expression, and in most cases no known function. And these pictures are, during the appropriate time window, two or three hours for the embryo, and these are considered positives by people in the business. So here, there's a little bit of staining here. Well, these are obvious. Nice zebra pattern. This is staining here. This blows up this, there's staining here, there's staining here, and there's this. So these are considered evidence that that gene, which is near to one of our modules, is blastoderm expressed.
Do you understand those little patches?
Which?
These little patches in terms of...
inputs? No. No. We do not. I mean, here this is in the head region. We have checked, and I'm not quite sure what we found. It's head. So hopefully Bicoid Hunchback inputs. But there's obviously a lot of other stuff we're missing, because this is head specific. We're missing lots of stuff.
How did you choose the threshold
These were done as honestly as we can get them to do them, in the sense that anything for which there was literature annotation, evidence of the fly genome, the fly base, et cetera, was taken out. Everything which looked mysterious, more or less sampled up and down the list, with maybe some bias towards things out in the unigene set because you had the clones, which is then a slight bias for things that are reasonably expressed somewhere. Yes. Yes. Yes.
How do you decide whether?
Okay. So this picture gives you. So you take the local maximum. You do that genome wide. That gives you a ranking, and then you take the top 146.
Wait. So to get the local maximum, you have to smooth over some window.
This is data which is computed for a window. And then, to the extent that there are lots of bumps together, we only call it once. So there's some fiddling to look at. In this region, we'll find whatever the max is, and we'll call that once and forget the stuff nearby. And similarly, similarly here, we'd call that and not that. Some trivial fiddling. The result is a rank list for the entire genome, and you just draw a line somewhere.
And when you make constructs, how much of
the? You typically take a bit over a kilobase. Centered on the peak. I'll show you, but it's a bit over. One uses one's eye and sees what's plausible. I mean, again, the biologists, they want things to work.
So
yes?
You have these pumps which is much broader than the.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So does that mean that there are actually signals going way out?
Okay, there are two things. One, these are the free energy computed for a window, and the window could partially overlap, so overlap the stripe and give you a signal.
But even if you look at the
sites, right, the sites are spread more, and nobody seriously believes that these are strict limits. I mean, the limits of these things are chosen because of their restriction sites there.
You pick up some non-specific feature of that sequence, yeah.
Things certainly are somewhat spread. There are sites everywhere, and the window does some smearing itself.
So do you assign the score to the center of the window or to the left or the right edge? If you assign it to the left edge, it would more or less be in the.
Yeah, there's. We have slightly shifted on that, and don't ask. It's dirty laundry. There's some slop in that, which I have forgotten which way it went. Okay. So here is a situation where, so this is the region around Giant, and this is Giant, this is the region around Giant, and there are prominent peaks here and here, neither of which were previously explored. These guys scooped us and looked at this one, and then we looked at this one and this one. This is the native Giant pattern, right? So you see anterior, posterior stripe. This is the result of looking at the module down here, which is more or less promiscuous staining, ubiquitous staining, but at the right time point. This is considered a good hit for the anterior stripe. Right, that's the upstream element right here. Right, so those two things were checked. This is CNRPS. This is a well-known gene. One should make now rather forcefully the point is that nobody knows where this is, right? This thing gives this, which is manifestly not that. And it's for you to guess where the missing module is, which gives you that pattern. Nobody knows. But there's not a lot of stuff here. And so that's a conundrum. Where is it? Well, we don't know. But manifestly, this gene does that. And this piece here is that. Where the rest is, nobody knows. This is CNRPS, a very well-studied gene. It's a gap gene. This is a known region which hits you on the head. There's another module we predicted an intron. Big prediction, right? You can't miss that. Not much else around. This is endogenous. This is the module. Note that it's more fuzzed out, but considered similar both here and here, but a little bit fuzzier. Note that it resides in an intron. And again, you can't miss it. You know, your threshold obviously is somewhat lower if I say, here's a gene, what's the most plausible module? As opposed to say, if give me a genome, where's the module, right? Because I know KNURPS is expressed in blastoderms, a gap gene.
So this module like Z is the specific module?
Yes, it's here.
What does the known module look
like? This one, I don't have that picture, so I don't know. Sorry, I should have checked. I don't know. Maybe it's more up here. I don't know. I have to check. That I didn't have. There's a lot of this stuff. Sloppy paired. There is, so these are two genes, sloppy paired 1 and 2. There is a, we predict a module between them. This is native for sloppy paired 1. This is the module. Somewhat similar, a little bit more smeared out. And certainly it's down here. That is considered a good hit. This is CNC. This is another intron. Nothing was known about this gene. Here, this note for your education. This thing is spread out over 20 kb. Right, very big gene, very spread out. So again, another module in an intron. This is the endogenous pattern. This is the module. You're getting this, and you're getting some vestige of a stripe here. People tend to believe that. And I don't know how much fiddling you have to do. These were both done by the same people, same lab, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how much fiddling you could do to get this thing to come up, I'm not clear.
Where was the module putting affected like Z gene? Is it in the intro that you tried putting it?
These things were all done, we're changing that, fairly close, but more importantly, these were all run on a HeatShock 70 promoter. So it's not the native promoter. And everybody, you know, when you make these constructs, you tend to put multiple modules in front of a common promoter. HeatShock 70 is rather standard. We are also going to a Eve promoter, which is at least somewhat more context appropriate. But nobody, to my knowledge, for each construct pulls out the native promoter. So it's certainly germane. So probably the biggest variable is we know that there are situations where the enhancer promoter do talk to each other in a specific way. And there are other variables which are, there are other context-specific variables which I will come to involved with insulators. So lots of things can be going on. So it gives you a sense of where else the signal might be coming from. It's not a black and white situation. That's the CNC. This is now KNURPS-related, another gene. This is not considered a decent match. So again, a very big gene, something in the intron. This is the endogenous pattern. This is what we get, rather different. Maybe we should look at this one, unclear. But there's not much else around for this gene. And so this is blastoderm specific, but the wrong pattern. This is hairy. So now this introduces a new subject. So what we have done here is this is the hairy upstream region, which we'll see a number of other times. These are very obvious peaks that sort of hit you on the head. And these are nicely coincident with most, but not all, of the hairy stripes. The hairy stripes. There's a 3, 4, there's a 5, 6, whatever, 7. Okay. Now, this is the endogenous hairy pattern, a nice 7-stripe thing. What we have done is to take these three modules, this, this, and this, and on these modules, we have simply said, we simply asked the computer to go look for sites, motifs. So the computer takes that data and looks for motifs. What it finds is some list of things. So it finds a motif which is very Krupa-like. It finds a motif which is a mixture of hunchback and caudal. And then it finds a motif which has no decent annotation. So what we do is we then take some of those new motifs and we run over the genome with them. And what we see then in this region is a big peak over here because it's not present in the pure gap maternal data is due to the new matrices. Okay, so then what we do is we take this chunk of sequence and we put it in the module, and we get this ubiquitous but blastoderm-specific expression. Okay, now, is that success or failure? Well, it certainly hasn't recapitulated the native pattern. It's unclear whether it's working on this gene, which is more or less unknown. But it's not so obvious why this doesn't influence that. I mean, one could make up arguments, but that's not so obvious. In any event, you have this thing which has blastoderm expression. Now, what sense do you make of that? Well, if you look at what's in there, we find after the fact that there are two very strong STAT sites in there, which we know to be ubiquitous activators. So somewhat by chance, or for whatever reason, these STAT sites have come up, and they may explain that ubiquitous activation. We do not know. I mean, they're obvious things to do, but they have not yet been done. Okay, so what can be said? Another 15 minutes or so? 15, 20 minutes? Okay. What can be gotten from interspecies comparisons? We have had for about 3 weeks now the sequence of another fly, more or less complete pseudo obscura. And how do we deal with this data? Well, the way this is dealt with, sort of in rough terms, is that you firstly position the genes, which are typically fairly easy to find because they're large. With respect to the genes, you then just do blasts between Melanogaster and the contigs from pseudo obscura. You will get a series of pair of blast scores between chunks of the two genomes. These chunks typically are, say, in the 50 base region. What you then do is that you find the optimal synthetase assembly, i.e. you take all these pairwise matches and you find the path through the set of pairs such that you have used in your path the maximal number of pairs. So you you preserve the order in the two species, and then you find that you choose the pairs which overall give you the highest score. And that tends to work fairly well, i.e. there's not a lot of microinversions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for these two flies. Having done that, you then have to promote all of your algorithms when they run to respect these similar synthetase regions, yet when they encounter stuff which is not aligned, they have to treat it as just an uncorrelated sequence. So if you're fitting matrices, you will separately fit matrices here and here if they work. When you're looking at the green regions, you obviously have to fit your matrices respecting the overall alignment, the blocks that BLAST or whatever has given back to you. So these things are treated as if related by descent. Stuff in here, for which we could see no homology, is just treated as two samples. So various algorithms are written so as to now work on this data structure. To see roughly what's going on, let me take again this region upstream of Hairy, which for some time we have had comparative data from Virulus. These are the various stripe elements that you saw in the previous graph. These are the various blocks that are assembled and are synthetase. They are offset really for visualization purposes. So if you just look at the density of these things, and if you like the size, you can't really have guessed where these modules fall if I showed you only these bars down here. There's no clean delineation. This is data from pseudo obscura. It's the same upstream region, now showing you a bit more stuff since we have a full contig spanning it all. Again, you can't really guess from where these blocks are occurring how to position and parse these modules, which are the experimentally known ones. This is the region around Eve, again for pseudo obscura. again, these are the various ETH modules. This is R-trace for reference. You see here for 3.7 that there's been an insertion into pseudo-obscura, which actually nicely marks the right boundary of 3.7, but these other guys are not, and maybe there's something here. The other ones are not particularly delineated, as you can see, certainly not stripe 2. Okay, what sense do we make of this? We can look at the data in somewhat more detail. We could take this optimal alignment, and we have a database or dictionary of roughly 300 or so experimentally defined binding sites for various proteins in the, typically the, you know, in the sort of early blastoderm expressed. And we could simply ask what fraction of those experimentally known sites coincide with sequence which is evolutionarily conserved, i.e. which can be mapped between the two species. So we fool around with various codes, various parameters, various this, various that. What is quite persistent as a conclusion is that the amount of conserved sequence, as you would have eyeballed from the previous picture, is about half the total. What is then a little bit surprising is that the using various measures of hit, that the amount, the fraction of known sites that fall within this conserved sequence is roughly half. You know, this versus this, or this versus this. What you expect by chance, i.e. respecting the conservation block structure, randomizing the sites using the same overlap criteria, is that you get a number less than, but not vastly less than, what you see for the real data. This being a z-score, so-called. So it's the argument of an error function. So, you know, there is, you know, given that you're making so many predictions, it is significant that 1,500 is bigger than 1,100, but it's not vastly bigger. So there's correlation, but not a lot. Yes?
You randomize
the sites. How?
Yes,
we've done it both ways. You would approve, but we've done it in ways we've done before. Okay, there's conserved tidbits. It depends. Various codes were used which do various things. The conserved tidbits are on the scale of, you know, tens of bases under 100 until you hit coding sequence.
But that depends on what
parameters? Yeah, it depends on a vast number of parameters. So what we have done, among other things, is we have looked through the entire parameter space, and we have optimized, say, the z-score. We've done 10 other things. We have huge tables. But the general conclusion is unaffected. But we have optimized for this. So you will not do better than that. Now, this does not mean, however, OK, so what this means in an evolutionary context is that these sites move around irrespective of larger conserved blocks. We can, however, show that if you simply look for the contents of the modules, just running the two species separately and looking at which matrices are there, you certainly do get useful information from the second species. So it's not as if the sites disappear. It's just that they're shuffled in some way, which is not easily to map via the sequence comparison. But the sites are there, and these algorithms, which just count sites and number, et cetera, do definitely benefit from the second species. So again, the thing to be emphasized is that the sites come and go in a way that you would not, in such a way that if you were to restrict attention to the parts of the sequence preserved between the species in any way that you could see via a blast and an assembly, you would certainly miss roughly half the known sites, and you basically would not be making good use of the data. Last subject I want to touch on is insulators. This is a it's a somewhat it's a subject which is not as widely discussed as that of modules, but in some sense it's equally important, because if you think for a moment, you have these vast tracts of sequence with modules hanging on them in various places, and it's not at all obvious which module goes with which gene. There are certainly module promoter interactions, but the fact that all of these constructs have been validated by using an exogenous promoter, typically Heatshock 70 or maybe Eve, means that the module promoter code is not terribly specific. You know, some promoters will work fairly promiscuously. However, due to interesting genetic studies and biochemistry, there have been a total of whatever 8, shall we say, confirmed insulator elements. The assay for an insulator is the following. Namely, I have a generic enhancer and I have a generic gene. If the insulator sits between them, the gene, you know, the enhancer gene communication is off. If I leave everything the same but put the insulator out, you know, not between the enhancer and the gene looks normal. Okay, so it's a chunk of sequence with this property. That's its operational definition.
So the order matters.
Order matters.
The spatial position
does not. Right. So this, the order definitely matters. A silencer is something which, if near an enhancer, shuts it down, irrespective of order. But this is specifically order dependent. And the assay for them does this check, that the order matters. And how this works mechanically at the protein level is not clear. Yes? It's as drawn. The gene over here would be operative. Yes. Okay. So this is the assay for these things, and there are various ones of these that have been examined over the past 15 or so years. In a number of cases, one knows the protein that has that binds. And what we have done is, among other things, looked at these sequences, tried to extract sites, using those sites, just run them over the genome and ask, do we find other similar insulators? Yes?
One more question about this.
Yes.
Right. For the silencing, which is distinct from the insulator.
Yes. Okay. So I've stuck in a silencer here because it's a very well-defined site, and there's a much bigger blob of things which form. But people have shown that a very small piece, you know, something, you know, they have multimerized this thing or multiplied to 20 or something. That conveys silencing. So this thing is sufficient. This is an instance where we took one of these very heavily studied insulators from a Shettle group at Princeton. You run it with your canonical motif finder. You see this stuff comes out, and you observe that this cluster of sites in this region happens to be the region that in this paper they showed to be functional. This is another one of these insulating elements, which has a very unusual distribution with respect to gene positions. Namely, what you see in this graph, for example, is the distribution of these elements with respect to the two flanking genes. So you see a huge pileup of these elements for genes which are close, whereas if you look at the ensemble of all gene pairs in the genome, you see that it's a very flat distribution, building up, increasing to about a kilobase and then being flat. So obviously these elements, this cluster of sites, is very non-uniform with respect to these types of gene pairs. And there's a lot of unpublished data around from the Courier plus literature stuff, which we quite handily hit. This is probably more of interest to the biologists. This is a very complex region of the genome, bithorax complex, where there is a huge amount of regulation of these homeotic genes going on in various genetically defined loci. This is just to say, so this is our scan for putative insulators. This is known stuff, some of which was used to train on, but you will observe that there are a lot of prominent peaks in here which are not associated with known stuff. Right? These things sort of go off the charts. So these are obviously things one wants to check. Okay, so to conclude from all this, the first remark is that it's surprising one gets anywhere. That is to say, the fact that these codes work at all means that there is that if one merely counts copies of factors in a restricted region, ignoring spacing and order, that works to get you roughly half of what is known, at least for blastoderm. The other thing, which I've not shown you in much detail, is that if you take the modules and try to invert and find the sites, there is the specificity of these factors is rather overlapping and not distinct. In other words, you could set up a sort of honest test of this sort, but it certainly seems to be quite common that these matrices have overlapping specificities, and you could certainly see sites that tend to morph from one specificity to another, right? Things are rather blurred. And whether that's an important part of the code or just what the system can live with is not clear. One certainly has to ask whether or not blastoderm is anomalous. So one obviously will very quickly play the same game with the various canonical signaling pathways, for which we have similarly good lists of sites. Also, one should remark that the blastoderm is rather different from situations such as glial cell development or circadian rhythms, which there are groups at Rockefeller working. There one has a regulator on top, so to speak, which has relatively few direct targets. In these chip experiments, you come out with hundreds of genes, which you can't simply explain by presence of the master, so-called. This is a rather generic situation, and one would like to see whether one can sort it out computationally. The other remark is that these pseudo-obscura comparisons are interesting, are very useful, but not in a trivial way. Much of the functional binding sites are not manifestly conserved between the species. A more general remark is that these negative examples, so to speak, things which don't work as you expect, are still quite informative for us, because given some theory, you could then ask, why is your theory wrong, or what do they have which other things do not have? So it's a plea for those who generate data to report the failures. They sometimes are as interesting as the successes. I mean, obviously, if Newton's equations failed for Venus and worked for all the other planets, we would not have heard of Newton except as a failed alchemist. And somewhat the same is true here, too. And it's also very interesting to, I mean, when you look at those computer pictures, it's quite, you know, it's an infinite speculation that those various bumps, which don't obviously coincide with any known module, are potentially the raw material from which new modules are made, i.e. they're things which have many of the right inputs, and to the extent that they're really off, they're things that you might be able to turn on with relatively few changes. You know, precisely how many changes we don't know, but one certainly does not seem to make these modules ex nihilo by from completely random sequence. You know, all the sequence around some of these genes has lots of the right inputs going into it. Lastly, a remark about insulators. A number of these insulators are associated with mobile elements, and of course it's an appealing speculation that's been made a long time ago that this might be also an interesting way, mechanism, for the genome to experiment with what's on and what's off. These things hop around, and they sort of, in one operation, turn off chunks of regulation and re-block how the regulatory sequence talks with which genes. And comparison with bacteria, I haven't really got into, so I just skipped that. Thank you. Other questions? Yes?
in the cases when Ahab misses a known strife element,
yes.
Are there any common characteristics of those
elements? Not that we have readily seen, but one wants to look. Either we're missing stuff, I mean, it could be stat sites, where nothing we've trivially seen. Yes?
When you're with metrics, do you matter when you find for those that are successful, are there like more than two copies of the same site? Or when the score is high, what is the
total
number?
It's variable. I mean, there are multiple factors, multiple qualities. Everything goes into the score. There's no simple statement.
You don't know whether you're...
I mean, for everything, we have a table of all, all numbers are known. But there's no simple statement that, because the algorithm weights number and quality. And they all get put together into a common free energy, and therefore, what's there is there. One obviously knows, but it's the list. I forgot to mention that on this fly work, I have been working with a group of people at Rockefeller, some new arrivals, some old arrivals, and all the experimental work was done with Ulrike Gohl, with whom I've been collaborating for many years, and whose obviously outlook and input heavily influences what we do as well as the measurements. And with the insulators, we've talked a lot with Olivier Cuvier at Cold Spring Harbor. Right. Other questions? No.
Among the 146, how many have been checked and what is
the... Okay, so the numbers are that we check literature, we check Flybase, et cetera, et cetera. We then did 24 in situs on genes that were otherwise not annotated, and of those 24, 7 whose pictures I showed you came up positive. So if you scale all the numbers up, the estimated false positive rate is 50%. Yes?
I have a question. So there are these transposable elements in flies.
Yes.
And so to what extent, comparing the two species, you can identify what hopped where?
Unclear. A lot of that happens. I don't think there's a lot of, we haven't looked too thoroughly as yet. A lot of things have moved in the past 40, 50 million years, which is the scale at which these things diverged.
But when you say that insulators hop about?
People speculate that they might hop about.
But is there a way that you can look at the data and actually associate your predictions for insulators with the...
Right. It is certainly fruitful. It is certainly fruitful to use the two species for that, and it's unclear what we haven't. We will do that. We haven't started doing that in a systematic way. I mean, you might say that certain things must be insulated, therefore preserved. I mean, for example, the situations which are rather amusing to look at, where these so-called beef elements occur, is that there are some number of genes, not a small fraction of the genome. But things down here, you have pairs of divergently transcribed genes. In some of these particular gene pairs, you have two genes whose promoters are a couple hundred bases apart, yet have differential expression. That's a tricky thing to engineer. So you would like to see that in the other species, for example, these very close gene pairs, if they exist, have similar elements in them, because it's clear that they have the same problem to solve. And there's not that much space to rattle around in.
Is even that conserved if you have such divergent promote in one species? How often do you find a similar thing in another?
We don't yet have, we have not yet checked. I mean, we've checked for one or two of these things, and they are preserved. I mean, in fact, other people have done that, that these particular pairs, one of these pairs is preserved in Virilis, I believe, and has the appropriate element in it. But there's a lot of these, right?
So in that case, is say the left gene euchromatic and the other heterochromatic, depending on the state of the cell, or?
It's unclear. This thing, okay, I don't know more generally how the other remark to be made is that these proteins, as far as we know, are reasonably ubiquitously expressed. So it's not clear how the regulation works. So maybe these things sort of tip the seesaw generally in one direction. You have to hit it pretty hard to go the other direction. Unclear. There's very few experiments on this stuff. Yes?
If these elements are malleable in the sense that it's the relative position, not the distance
yes.
between them, those almost elements that you find, things that don't correspond to anything known in Melanogaster, do they correspond to, if you define it just as a bundle of these transcriptions,
yes.
do they correspond to things that are, you, or can you look?
The protein, when we know which proteins bind to these insulators, we haven't, I forget which have been checked for virulence, we haven't yet checked for pseudo-obscure. We presume these are there. I mean, most proteins are there. So certainly the odds would be yes, and these things are probably important. And this DREF is a fairly ubiquitous factor and so on.
Yeah. Last step expression is that last term specific or
I'm not sure. I think that's known. I don't know.
The other question is, have people for the, so in the cases where you predicted the module and it was also a known module, have you or the original office looked at the Lexi reporter essay for the known module to look at the context dependent?
When the module was known, i.e. there was an experiment around, you know, and somebody deleted it and cut it out, we or nobody else has gone back to look. I mean, you could argue the positions aren't quite right, the boundaries weren't quite right, and so on.
Because if you think that for your new module, the context may play a role, you could get a sense of that for the known.
You could certainly take more or less. I mean, you know, typically these experiments were done where you chop, 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 mm-hmm. and you just look at the expression of everything, and then you know the expression flips over. So to some extent, you know that from the original papers. Oh, in the constructs, it's close. You're less than a kilobase. In the real thing, it could be much further. I don't think so. I don't think they think it's terribly important. I don't think it's believed to be terribly important, but with constructs it's been looked at. I mean, certainly people will make big constructs with multiple things on them. And see that at the distalmost functions. So, incidentally, yes, but I don't think anyone has tried to make a very big thing and put what they appear to be junk in the middle, i.e. bacterial sequence in the middle. Because that's not perceived, it was checked once and has not been gone back to.
Alternatively, when people make these constructs and so they decide that they're going to put an enhancer, bases behind the promoter, and it works on the first trial, or it doesn't work, and then one tries to put it somewhere else, and reports again all the successful cases?
There's a great deal of selective reporting. In our hands, or I should say in Gall's hands, obviously, she used a different mobile element which had insulators around it, which was known to work later on in a fruitful way. That gave chaos in Blastoderm. Things were all over the place. So they changed it, and they went back to something more conventional.
So could it be that then, instead of kicking out the...
Unclear, right, okay. There was a very curious experiment which was reported in Science a couple of years ago. This gypsy is a very strong insulator, and it's obviously part of a transposon. They took pairs of insulators and put them between an enhancer and the gene. And pairs of enhancers seem to have globbed onto each other and given you expression. One insulator off, two insulators on. That's the way it is. That's what happened. Okay, for these insulators, as far as one knows, it's more or less one protein. I mean, here it's suppressor of hairy wings, here it's ZSTY5. There are two here, one sort of generic. By and large, not.
Okay, then we should thank Eric again and continue further.